From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Coming up, national outrage is still growing after two people were killed by federal immigration agents in Minnesota. Now, organizers in Pike County say ICE activity closer to home is raising alarms. We'll speak with Delaware Valley Action about the candlelight vigil that they're holding for ICE victim Alex Pretty in Milford, PA tonight. And that vigil starts soon. It starts at 6:30. Radio Catskill's Patricio Romayo continues his series on smoking tonight, looking at the financial costs of the habit. And we're going to check in with New York Focus's Colin Kinneborough, who has three questions for the state's climate and energy leaders, even as those leaders meet in Albany today for a budget hearing specifically on New York's energy future. That story is coming right up. But first, we do have news from the Hudson Valley, where buying a home is increasingly becoming more expensive. That's according to the latest data from housing nonprofit Hudson Valley Pattern for Progress. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar has more.
A new report from the housing nonprofit Hudson Valley Pattern for Progress says that median home prices have climbed over $350,000 in all nine counties in the Hudson Valley. Rockland County recorded the region's highest median sale price at $715,000 in 2025, while Sullivan County remained the most affordable at $350,000. Overall, housing inventory in the region has increased over the past 2 years. More retirees putting their homes on the market and remote work may have contributed to the boost, according to the report. But local housing experts urge that home ownership is still out of reach for many residents due to limited inventory and affordability. The report notes that overall inventory is still, quote, extremely depressed from its pre-pandemic baseline, end quote. In Liberty, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Kimberly. Now on to news from Albany, where New York lawmakers held a very long budget hearing today focusing on the state's energy future. From new nuclear power to data centers, even to Governor Kathy Hochul's plans for housing, the stakes are high and the debate is just heating up. And New York's lofty climate goals are still there, kind of looming above all of this, for now anyway. Governor Hochul's administration is starting to lay out its case to roll back parts of an environmental law to fast-track affordable housing. Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner Amanda Lefton told the Joint Budget Committee that the proposal would streamline environmental impact review for certain projects.
We want to be thoughtful about how we can ensure that we're meeting the multiple goals of the state of increasing affordable housing, as well as advancing environmental protections and continuing to prioritize our natural resources.
The plan is supported by business and real estate groups. Environmental organizations say any changes should be limited to protect land and water quality. Colin Kinneborough, who covers the state's environmental and climate laws and politics for New York Focus, was at that hearing in Albany today. In his latest article, he lays out three key questions that he has for climate and energy leaders in the state. Colin Kinneborough spoke with Tim Bruno from that hearing in Albany live this morning on Radio Chatskill, and he started with Governor Hochul's stated all-of-the-above approach to energy.
That's a line we've heard a lot from the governor and from others in her administration over the last year. And, you know, to my mind, it really calls back Democratic politicians, you know, back in the Obama era when the U.S. was really building out its, you know, fracking infrastructure and everything. But here we are talking about all of the above energy again. The governor, that's included approving that gas pipeline, as you mentioned, that the state previously rejected. But she's also really emphasized nuclear, and I think has surprised people, at least me, with the scale of the build out she wants. Last year she talked about getting the power authority to build one or more power plants that would add up to 1 gigawatt of new energy. So that's essentially, you know, that could be just one large power plant. Now she's talking about potentially 4 more, or even more if they're smaller reactors, that would be built by private companies. So that's quite ambitious. It sets the state up for potentially 10 years or more of planning and lots of debate and local fights over, you know, where these power plants are going to go and whatnot. So quite an ambitious proposal there.
What do you see as the key risks here and opportunities, I guess, of prioritizing reliability and energy diversity in the current budget when you compare that to the more traditional clean energy first approach?
One thing you hear a lot from the governor and her administration is that partly this is, you know, this shift in strategy from the renewables first approach, as you called it, is really driven by necessity, by the changing federal administration. You know, New York was counting heavily on offshore wind off the coast of Long Island to supply quite a lot of its energy, maybe up to about, you know, 15% of the state's entire energy supply. As your listeners probably know, Trump has really gone to war with offshore wind, and it's been touch and go even for the projects that are under construction. So, you know, by bringing more gas into Long Island and the New York City area, the governor would say she's just shoring up what's needed for reliability. The nuclear, as far as the risks, you know, with nuclear, I mean, a lot of environmentalists over the years, of course, have raised concerns about health, about nuclear waste and other things. I think these days when everyone's talking about affordability, I mean, the cost of these new plants is a major question on my mind, and I think on a lot of people's minds. Nuclear has been historically very expensive to build in this country. The last nuclear power plant that was built in the U.S. in Georgia is by some counts the most expensive power plant ever built on Earth. So, you know, can New York do it differently? I think that's a very open question. Everyone wants reliable energy, but no one wants their bills going up, and the governor has made a big point of that. So how she squares all of these things is an open question to me.
Yeah, that's one of the other questions you said you would ask if you had the chance to ask questions. How will you ensure that Governor Hochul's nuclear plans won't drive up New Yorkers' bills? And as you said, critics often argue that nuclear builds are costly and slow. We've clicked through two of your questions. I guess the third one here is about data centers. How does New York plan to make data centers pay their fair share?
Right. This is a concept that's been gaining a lot of traction. I mean, I started hearing about it kind of from climate and environmental groups and you know, consumer advocates sometime last year. I just saw that, you know, even Trump is talking about this now, that, you know, no, a regular customer should not be footing the bill for the power that all the power, the huge amount of power that data centers are drawing from the grid. I think in some states we have started to see that happen. And so it seems like there's really bipartisan interest at this point in making sure that, you know, as the governor put it, data centers pay their fair share. Either maybe they pay a little bit more for the power that they draw, or they even build their own energy on site. That's one approach that's been talked about. So far, we have not gotten any details on what the governor means by pay their fair share. I thought we might see some legislation, some draft legislation in the budget last week, but it wasn't actually in there. She's, as with many energy issues in New York, she's leaving it in the hands of the Public Service Commission, that sort of semi-independent agency that regulates utilities. So maybe we'll get a preview today from the commissioner, Rory Christian.
Yeah. Can you read the tea leaves a little bit there? That you know, line in the State of the State, putting the AI industry on notice, saying, you know, that they want to build in New York, they'll have to pay their fair share. That drew a lot of praise from environmentalists. And some of them have grown unused to cheering for the governor, as you report. But, you know, if she's not giving any details and sort of letting the Public Service Commission take, you know, charge here, or what does that tell you?
Well, at its core, this is an issue about, you know, rates, electric rates, which is really the commission's bread and butter. You know, they spend all their time deciding rate cases and getting into the nitty-gritty of what kinds of customers pay what amounts. So in that sense, you know, it makes sense that they would be dealing with it. The way this happened in Oregon, which is the state you hear about from some of the climate advocates. The way they did this was to create a new rate class for these data centers, and that's something the Public Service Commission could certainly do here as well. The biggest kind of open question to me is if there is sort of the stipulation that these data centers bring, you know, supply their own power. How would they do that? What kinds of requirements would they be? Would there be? Would it have to be, you know, purely clean energy, zero emissions energy, whether in the form of, you know, perhaps solar and batteries or something like a nuclear plant? Or would they be allowed to build, you know, a gas plant, for example, as many data center companies have been doing in other states? Would they have to put some kind of, you know, carbon capture on it? So I think there's a lot of questions about not just the cost of building these data centers, but how they do so in a way that could mesh with the state's climate law.
Just going back to this all of the above strategy and this shift from Governor Hochul when it comes to climate and energy goals, how much of that do you think has to do with her bid for reelection?
That's a great question. I think certainly we've seen the tone shifting from Democrats across the country as it's become more challenging to build renewables. And there's been a lot of opposition from Washington. I think we've seen everybody across the political spectrum really embracing, you know, affordability and reliability as the core goals over cutting pollution. So it's hard to say. I mean, there are some things, for example, the state's cap and invest program that which was supposed to raise a ton of money for climate initiatives, kind of be a core way of how the state was going to implement its climate law, that is still up in the air and looks like potentially essentially just being punted until after November as it makes its way through the courts. So I think there could be very well be some political calculus here, but of course I can only speculate.
That's Colin Kinnebrough from New York Focus. He is live in Albany at the hearing on energy, climate, and the environment as part of the month-long marathon of budget hearings in Albany. Lawmakers are grilling top state energy and environmental officials. We'll let you get back, Colin. I think you said that in recent years, this hearing has stretched to 12 hours or more, so I hope you brought a snack.
I certainly did.
Colin Kinnebrough, New York Focus. You can find more of his reporting at nysfocus.com. Colin, thanks.
Thank you. Great speaking with you.
And thank you, Tim Bruno. Well, also on Radio Chatskill this morning, Tim Bruno spoke with the folks who are holding a candlelight vigil tonight. It's happening at 6:30, so it's coming up soon. They'll be joined by local faith leaders in Milford, Pennsylvania, to mourn and express frustration over the loss of Alex Preddy, the most recent American citizen to lose their life to immigration officers in a shooting in Minneapolis. This follows the fatal shooting of Renee Nicole Good in Minneapolis on January 7th. Both incidents have sparked nationwide protests and calls for accountability. Locally, residents in and around Pike County are organizing responses and resistance. Radio Catskills' Tim Bruno spoke with Taylor James, board member of Delaware Valley Action and co-president of DVA, and Martha Ramon of DVA. And DVA is Pike County's local indivisible group. Here's Taylor.
National attention has turned to federal immigration enforcement, especially after the fatal shootings of Alex Preddy and Renee Nicole Good by federal immigration agents in Minneapolis, incidents that have sparked nationwide protests and calls for accountability. Locally, residents in and around Pike County are organizing responses and resistance. With us are Taylor James, board member of Delaware Valley Action, and co-president of DVA, Martha Ramon. DVA is Pike County's local indivisible group. Thank you for both being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Taylor, you're organizing a candlelight vigil for Alex Preddy tonight. Why was it important for Delaware Valley Action to organize this vigil here in Pike County, and why now?
Yes, absolutely. Tonight at 6:30, we're all meeting. We are pretty much the organization in town that responds, I think, when our community needs things. And we have a lot of empathetic, beautiful people in our area who were really heartbroken and horrified by what happened in Minnesota. And we really just needed to bring them together to mourn and to kind of have a place to place all of this energy that we're feeling. We were able to have a vigil a few weeks back for Renee. And it was a really beautiful and unifying night for our community. And so we feel it's our responsibility as a community organization to kind of rise up and provide these opportunities for our people to come together and to be around people who are feeling the same pain they're feeling right now, you know?
What we see is people are very concerned about the violence nationwide, not what we are about. And so we want to express that, although our vigil tonight is really to mourn and to express our outrage at the senseless killing in Minneapolis.
Thanks again to Tim Bruno. Taylor James, board member of Delaware Valley Action and co-president of DVA, and Martha Ramon of DVA. Again, that vigil is happening in Milford, and it's starting soon, coming up at 6:30 this evening.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It is The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. Radio Catskill's Patricio Rabayo has been digging deep into the issue of tobacco. Last night he covered kids and smoking. Tonight, it's the cost of smoking, not just to people's health, but to their wallets. A report from Wallet Hub finds that smoking costs the U.S. economy more than $600 billion a year. And New York State ranks third in the nation for overall financial costs of smoking, with the average smoker facing nearly $6 million in lifetime costs when you factor in health care, lost income, and missed investment opportunities. Patricio Rabayo spoke with Chip Lupo, a Wallet Hub analyst who worked on the report.
Well, Wallet Hub, we are primarily a personal finance website. So when we generate data-driven studies like this to try to come up with some kind of correlation when it comes to finances, and in the case of smoking, what we wanted to expand on more than just the out-of-pocket cost of tobacco products, which are through the roof, whether it's just depending on what state you live in with taxes and everything like that, to go beyond that, because there are secondary economic factors when it comes to smoking, things such as healthcare costs. Your insurance, your health insurance, if you're a smoker, you're going to be paying higher in health insurance. You're going to be missing, taking time off of work, losing income in that respect in the time that you're seeking medical attention for smoking-related issues. And we did a little something interesting, too, where we analyzed how much residents in a state spend on smoking. If they were to invest that money in the stock market, how much money they would have lost over the lifetime of their smoking.
And how much is it? Because in your report, I remember seeing that it's millions of dollars over a lifetime.
Yes, in New York in particular, but we're talking, again, $600 billion. And there are still a little over 49 million tobacco users in the country, which is a really high number because it wasn't that long ago, you would turn on a television sitcom, you see like a cop drama or something, and everyone's sitting there smoking cigarettes and at their desks, and just, you don't see that as much anymore. But even though it's not ingrained in pop culture, 49 million smokers or tobacco users, that's a very high number.
Yeah, I remember during my lifetime, remember watching commercials, used to have cigarette commercials.
Yes, and it's been a while since those are banned, but that doesn't deter people from going out and buying cigarettes.
New York ranked third overall. What factors push the cost here so high compared to other states?
Now, the thing about New York now, if you want to call it good news, for New York was number one a year ago, so they dropped down to third. But the numbers are still staggering because New York is behind Washington, D.C. and Maryland. But New York numbers have not necessarily dramatic drops, but the Maryland and Washington, D.C. numbers just leapfrogged them. The average New Yorker is going to spend about almost $6 million over their lifetime in smoking. And only a little over a quarter million of that is just out-of-pocket costs. And as we spoke a minute ago, that includes things such as financial opportunity costs per smoker. New Yorkers lose about $93,000 a year over a lifetime. That's actually per year. Now, over the lifetime, a smoker is going to lose almost $4.5 million. over the course of a lifetime, and that includes things such as your homeowner's insurance. Now, keep that in mind also, because how many times have you heard of house fires being started from someone smoking? So it's not just your health insurance that's going to be affected if you're a smoker. It's also going to affect your homeowner's insurance. And homeowner's insurance is already going up for a lot of other reasons. So if you're a smoker, that's only going to add to the cost.
You mentioned that smoking can't affect a person's earning potential over a lifetime, over time. How is that possible?
Well, a number of reasons is because if you're spending on cigarettes, obviously that's money that you could be spending elsewhere. For example, like we spoke of a second ago, it could affect your retirement budget by about $4.5 million in New York. Now, that's assuming that you took that money, the $255,000 that you're spending on tobacco products, and investing that in the S&P 500 in the stock market. So that's one cost. But there's other costs too, also, like costs of secondhand smoke, family members, coworkers, or people that are just in your overall everyday environment are affected by secondhand smoking. So it's not just the smoker that suffers in a lot of cases.
Can we expand on a little bit? How do these costs ripple out to families and communities?
Again, because let's just suppose you're working in a company and has a group healthcare plan. The more people who check off on when they're signing up for their benefits or checking off their smokers, that's going to drive up the costs for everyone. The company's not going to eat those costs. They're going to try to make it up somewhere. So everyone is affected in that case. Healthcare costs, the same thing. The more and more people that are going into hospitals or doctor visits for smoking-related issues, that affects waiting times for people with other types of medical aid. So it's a domino effect. It affects, again, not only individual within your household, but it affects people outside of your community as well.
Now, you also looked at secondhand smoke as well. How does that factor into the overall economic costs?
Well, secondhand smokers do suffer smoking-related diseases, whether they've ever touched a tobacco product or not. And again, those same factors come in. People who are going in for medical visits for smoking-related issues, even though they don't smoke, again, same thing. And so that's time and money spent that could be allocated elsewhere treating people with other types of illnesses or conditions.
For someone thinking about quitting, how quickly do the financial benefits start to show?
Now, that depends on how far you are into. Now, make no mistake about it. Smoking is an addiction. So it depends on how far you are into your addiction. And reason I say that is because people. Now, you would think. Now, New York places enormous taxes on a pack of cigarettes. The theory being that if you want less of something, you tax it. But if you're addicted to smoking, people are willing to pay that extra amount of money for those cigarettes. So the sooner you quit, the more likely you are to A, become healthier, save money to invest or to get yourself out of debt, for example. And then, of course, insurance rates will go down. So overall, there's a ton of financial and health benefits related to quitting smoking. You just have to, now it depends on how far along are you. If you've been smoking for 40 some years, it's going to be harder to quit. If you're just someone who's just starting smoking and noticing that the costs are starting to go up and maybe you're not feeling your best, it's a good time to quit because it's easier to quit before you get too addicted.
From your perspective, do people generally underestimate the long-term financial impact of smoking?
They do. When it comes to smokers primarily are looking just how much it costs as a pack or a carton of cigarettes. And this is the point of the study like this, to illustrate that there are other costs, even though you don't see them, and you're going to grumble when your house and home insurance and your health insurance. But in a lot of cases, they're not putting two and two together. So the point of a study like this is to illustrate that there are secondary costs, even though you don't actually aren't maybe not aware of them or don't see them on paper. those are all related, and that's what we try to do here, is just to try to drive home the point that there are other costs to smoking other than just going out and buying cigars, cigarettes, or other tobacco products.
Are there any particular age groups or income groups that are hit hardest by these costs?
Our study doesn't get into that, but I can tell you just anecdotally that it does affect lower income folks, again, because the taxes that are on cigarettes and the cost of cigarettes, and then lower income people, if you're addicted, you're going to maybe forego some other thing. It's like gambling or any other type of addiction. You're going to forego some necessities to continue to feed your addiction. And if you're of a low income, that's going to affect you more harshly than in residents in states maybe with higher annual incomes.
Chip, if there's one takeaway you hope listeners remember from this report, what would it be?
Just keep in mind that if you're addicted to smoking and you're one person who goes through two packs a day and are buying cigarettes on a regular basis, keep in mind that there are other costs involved. Ask yourself, is this money that could be spent elsewhere? Or the next time you wake up with a wheezing cough or some types of lung issues, ask yourself, is this really worth it? And how much money could I be putting away by giving up smoking?
Chip, before we go, is there anything else I have not touched on? Do you want folks to know about this report?
Yeah, one thing I did want to touch on, Patricia, if you look at the states that spend the least on smoking, now this is ironic because let's randomly just start from the bottom up. Mississippi, my home state of North Carolina, Missouri, Alabama, Tennessee, Kentucky. Among these states are the states that produced the most tobacco, the highest tobacco-producing states in the country, yet their costs are lower. Now, that suggests to me that maybe the tobacco companies and the farmers in some of these states, that they're doing, it seems that maybe they're doing something to create awareness among your industry. Now, whether that was through litigation or something, maybe they were forced to do. But I do find it interesting, the states that produce the most tobacco winds up costing their state residents less.
That's interesting. Now, I did just look at the map, the Wallet Hub map. I did notice that it's more like the northern states that have higher costs for smoking.
Yeah, that is it. Yeah, that's interesting too, because now part of that higher cost does come in the form of tobacco taxes. And in a lot of cases, in some of these densely populated northeastern states, stress levels are involved in a lot of cases, whether it's just the day-to-day, and some people turn to tobacco products as more or less of a relax or a reprieve from the day-to-day grind in some of these states, particularly in these urban environments. Yeah, that was interesting that Washington, D.C., Maryland, New York, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts were all at the top of the list.
Yeah, well, very interesting. Like I said, I love data, so I'm just looking at the map and everything else that you have, and I'm just curious. I don't know if this is going on topic here, but how long does it take for you and your other associates to put a report like this together?
From the day it runs, and then we're already starting to look at compiling numbers for next year's study. Now, of course, a lot of that depends on, we do rely heavily on government data and data from reputable third-party think tanks and research groups. So, yeah, the work begins. It's never ending. So from the time this one gets published, we're already looking to compare and contrast numbers for next year.
We're talking to Chip Lupo with Wallet Hub, breaking down the real financial cost of smoking. You can find the full report, including state-by-state rankings, at wallethub.com. And also, we'll have a link on our website at wjffradio.org. Chip, again, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. We appreciate your interest in our work, Patricio. You have a great day.
Big thanks to Patricio Rubio for that report. Thanks to our whole team here at Radio Catskill, and thank you for listening to The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me. I'll be back again tomorrow evening. We'll talk to Philip Pantuzzo, get the latest news from the Times Union. Coming up, we've got 2 hours of great music from Daryl Brogdon on the Retro Cocktail Hour, but before that, more news on the way from The Daily. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Rourke Law Liberty, New York, a general law practice serving the Catskills and Delaware River Valley with an emphasis on estate planning, estate administration, elder law, and real property matters. RourkeLaw.com. from the Neversink General Store, featuring deli sandwiches, gourmet specials, and catering. TheNeversinkGeneralStore.com. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Warming centers are open across our region to provide a safe, heated place for anyone who needs it. If you or someone you know needs a warm place to go, you can find a full list of locations and hours at WJFFradio.org. Radio Catskill, keeping our neighbors connected.